daddy. Ain't we lucky? Ain't we happy? Everybody is all so happy. Everybody's happy now. Sex galore, but no more marriages. No more pushing baby carriages. Nobody gotta change that sticky nappy.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Gnostic Media Podcast. That was the Victor McRae version of Everybody's Happy Now by Aldous Huxley. And this is Gnostic Media's podcast, episode number 255. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. And also thanks to Chris Mayville once again for creating the new introduction clip for the video version of the show. And we're still making some tweaks, and it's mostly fixed. We have the new final version up, but we're still having some rendering issues. Hopefully that'll get fixed soon, but I'm really liking it. So thanks to him for making that. Episode 255 is the long-awaited return of Dr. Hans Utter to continue our saga into the Grateful Dead, titled Laying the Dead to Rest, Part 2, Legends, Narrative Warfare, and Hippie Psychopolitics. This episode was recorded on September 28 and is being released on Saturday, October 22nd, 2016. I believe this is Hans's 15th time for this show, plus all of the CCN and RBN appearances over the last couple years. Probably about 25 shows total, and there will be, I believe, a complete list of those appearances up on the notes for this episode. And contributions. This episode is brought to you by Heath, William Lewis, Hannon, Jonathan, Scott, Derek, Greg, Casey, Oscar, Barry, Randy, Steve, Richard, Clyde, Kim, Bill, Camille, Gina, Bridget, Marty, Paul, and Matthew, James, Alan, Marie, and we had a few more server donations. We're now at 881 towards a new server, and thanks to Melinda, Michael, Sean, and Paul for donations toward that, and an unknown Bitcoin donation. Thanks to you as well. And of course, thanks to everybody for donating and getting a membership to the show, etc. We can't do it without you. Of course, we do our best to provide everything here for free, putting the show out for the first 6 weeks, etc., free of charge. But your donations, website purchases, and memberships are what keep everything going. Thanks for your help and support. Please also check out the store page on the website. We have items up there, books, t-shirts, videos, etc. Thanks so much. The views expressed by the authors and guests are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. The website, GnosticMedia.com, GnosticMedia.com. You can reach me directly through the contact form on the website or at contact@GnosticMedia.com. Thanks for listening and thank you for your support. And here's Dr. Hans Etter, Laying the Dead to Rest, Part 2, Legends, Narrative Warfare, and Hippie Psychopolitics. Enjoy. Dr. Hans Etter, welcome back to the Gnostic Media Podcast. This is part two of Laying the Dead to Rest, and it's good to have you back.
It's good to be back.
You've been on the show like, I don't know, 1,075,000 times or something like that, I think, by now. The most popular guest I think we've had, and we've definitely dug down deep into this whole world of intelligence and occult and how they control the public mind through media and pop culture and music and film. And today we're gonna cover a lot of people's favorite subject, their favorite heroes, the Grateful Dead. So today we're going to lay the dead to rest. And of course, you know, the CIA, They seem to be willing to let some of these other agents get exposed, but they seem really adamant to hold on to Saint Jerry Garcia and paint him as, you know, this lofty, godlike figure. And so, you know, we just want to make it clear that none of the Grateful Dead are out of reach, and if you're an agent, you're going to get exposed, so Jerry Garcia, he's no saint, and like all the others, like Bob Weir and all the other guys hanging out at Bohemian Grove and hanging out with the CIA and the others, Jerry Garcia gets the axe too. So, Hans, welcome to the show, and this is part two. I want to also mention that I did have a computer crash. I apologize to everyone for the delay for getting this series out. I had lost all the production files and the production I'd already done on part one, and so I'm having to start from scratch on all of that as well. So all of this will probably end up going out just about together. Anyway, welcome back.
Yeah, it's great to be back. And you know, the Grateful Dead, one of those bands that, you know, I had a passing interest in a little bit. I went to some shows, and then I started to hate the Grateful Dead just because they bored me. And then I said, oh, they're a little bit musically complex. You know, they have some kind of intellectual aspect to their music. But as I've, you know, gone into this research, I would have to say that they are one of the most occult bands, you know, called satanic or whatever, bar none. I don't think Slayer is like a bunch of little grandmothers knitting, you know, compared to
I saw somebody in the post office the other day wearing a Slayer shirt with a big old satanic upside down pentagram and all this stuff on it, you know, and I was just like sitting there just wanting to say something, but going, oh, I'm just going to keep quiet. So the Slayer is a bunch of knitting grandmas. I'm sure they'll appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that when you look at the 1960s, right, as this laboratory of the collective consciousness, not only of America, but of the world, and this transformational series of transformational events that occurred, and the interconnections of music with that, you see very clear demarcations of particular actors, particular players, particular junctures. And even as some clips we'll listen to later, Jerry talks about the fact that every 30 years there's a repeat of history. And he said, this was done in the 90s, and he said, now rock and roll, the 60s are being imported to Eastern Europe. They're having all these revolutions, right? So this importation of a revolutionary social model through music and the associated culture is an important part of it. But on the other side of it is this idea of the transmutation of the mind itself. And you know, we have to go from the level of individual to the collective experience of reality, the foundations that have been built up over tens of thousands of years, or about 3,000 years if you're a creationist, that basically it takes a lot to really transform society in a drastic way, as has been done in such a short time. And the 1960s, just talking about music, we look at Harry Smith and the Anthology of American Folk Music, which was the template for all of these artists, all of these musicians, that this became the Bible for Jerry, for countless other musicians. But Harry Smith himself was, he said, this, you know, this project is a weapon of consciousness, right, that will transform America. And he was a misanthrope. You know, he basically hated America. I mean, to a certain extent, and the quote unquote family values, you ever want to call it. And we'll see that the alchemical aspect of the Grateful Dead, the desire to destroy the family, and as well as the creation of a virtual reality matrix where everyone is completely in their own little mind, in their own little world. While they're interacting with people, they're basically, they fuse their minds into the machine, so to speak. And that's why initially the Grateful Dead came up, because of Pokemon Go, which you've talked about on the show. And when I first, you know, saw Pokemon Go, as I said, you know, before, I was traveling around the country over the summer, and I would go to all these different cities and see these bizarre scenes. And I thought I stepped into a science fiction movie. I was in Houston, and I was in a big square, nice place, all the teenagers hanging out, complete silence, maybe 100 people, and everyone just at their phone, just walking around in these little circles, no one even looking at each other. And I didn't even know Pokemon Go was what it was at that time. And I saw this in many locations. And in fact, I've gotten some contact.
And you had called me, in fact, while it was all going on, and you were here in California up north, and you called me right away. I think you're in California. Maybe you were in Texas by then, or both, but... just totally astounded at all of the zombies going around following their phones. And, you know, and that's the whole joke, everybody. If you haven't figured out that the zombies are the stupid people, they're making fun of you.
Yeah. But, you know, on another level, which is more interesting, with it, I had a contact from one of the listeners to this show, and she told me about her friend has a beautiful neighborhood, and there was this very pristine park. You know, he'd been there for a long time, decades and decades. And suddenly, with Pokemon Go, the entire park got invaded. It started getting trashed. They started even murdering dogs and stuff. The entire neighborhood has been destroyed because of people going there, following the Pokemon Go. And then they're starting to do vandalism and all kinds of other stuff. So this pristine neighborhood in this hidden little locality that no one knew about, suddenly they're being drawn there directly from Pokemon Go, and then engaging, like I said, animal sacrifice. I don't know exactly how or why, but this beautiful area has been destroyed through Pokemon Go. And that's exactly this mobilization of crowds and the collective transformation of behavior, right? And another part of this is removing empathy. And that's something you might notice, you know, in the younger generation, especially with the... you know, the YouTube and the virtual sort of world, you know, a lot of kids, you know, they lose empathy. They go with this idea that, okay, even if the Illuminati or the Sabbateans or whoever is in charge, they deserve to be in charge because they've won. They're smarter and they're better. So if they want to kill everybody, that's just fine. I'll just go back and play my, you know, first person shooter game or my other thing so I can go work as a drone pilot and kill people. But That's one level. But we're looking at the fabric, the social fabric, right? And we're also looking at the fabric of consciousness. At the same time, according to Owsley and members of the Dead, they're actually, you could describe it as ripping a hole in the space-time porthole to allow these energies to descend into humanity and, you know, molding the human consciousness. Now, if you want to, you know, you can take this to the sort of more esoteric plane, which is basically where they're coming from.
Well, what they've cleverly done is remarketed mind control as evolution.
Exactly. And is freedom. And so again, just like if you read the Aquarian Conspiracy, which we've talked about, you know, that book seems really, on a certain level, this seems really happy and really good. And in fact, there are some positive ideas in there, but it's just like communism. You want to help, you know, I want everyone to be able to eat food. I want to be rich. I want to drive a nice car. I want to be able to afford lots of cocaine and whores. You know, I'm not saying that, but that's, you know, Wolf of Wall Street, that's promoting that culture, right, through the film. But the idea is that, you know, from entertainment as the vector of transformation of the foundation of the human species, when you start interfering with proper family systems, when you start interfering with proper intellectual cognitive development, when you start taking away morality, when you start to move people into these other realms of consciousness, but they're being directed into certain places. At least according to, many of the prominent psychologists like Ewan Cameron, that insanity can be spread collectively. This idea that social movements can spread like a contagious disease. And so in a certain way, going back to Ken Kesey driving around in 1964, spreading LSD, they were spreading a contagion of this insanity. And in fact, the whole point was to embrace insanity, right? And so I just want to read a quote before I get into Owsley. So Hank Harrison, the manager of the Grateful Dead, himself very much interested deeply in the occult, and also interested deeply in the study of the hippie movement. He described himself as the Jane Goodall of the 1960s. So he's not even an anthropologist. He's studying the monkeys, right? But he described, he said, so he said,
oh, and, wow. Okay. Got it.
And he said that what we wanted to do, we wanted to go from Pavlov's dog to Lily's dolphins, right? So instead of controlling people, and he directly says that in his book, The Grateful Dead, which that book was disavowed and shut down by the Dead because he said too much, right? He said things that he was not supposed to talk about in public, you know, not for the cattle out there. They're not allowed to listen to that. But here's a quote about Saul Alinsky, the manager of manager of the Warlocks, and formerly known as the Zodiacs, so the Dead went from the Zodiacs to the Warlocks to the Grateful Dead. And that was around the time the Zodiac Killer was getting started too. So you got that little interesting thing, and the Zodiac Killer is part of this as well, to a certain extent, the whole PSYOP. But there's a quote from David Crosby about Saul Alinsky. Quote, Harrison was no hippie drug addict or pothead burnout. He always looked clean. In fact, he was a trained shrink. The first time I saw him, he was wearing a seersucker suit and a bow tie and carrying an attaché case. I could venture that Harrison was a CIA operative or a Saul Alinsky graduate in charge of organizing bands. And that's rock bands, right? So that's a Grateful Dead's manager. And so, you know, and again, I can't stress too much that, as we talked about in Music, Mind Control, and Psychobiology, the agenda of this, you describe as this occultic dimension, the intelligence operations have been wedded going back to the Hashishans, Hassani Sabah, John Dee, et cetera. So these things have been interconnected and intermingled. But the idea with this alchemical occult magic, so to speak, it's just like genetically modified food. You want to take over natural processes, subsume them, control them, and develop them. And that I think is a fundamental, whether you can place that in a scientific paradigm, right? I mean, you look at what's going on, the genetic manipulation through vaccines, right? Changing people's DNA, absolutely, et cetera, et cetera. This is this idea of, this goes directly back to this alchemy or this science, right? And I'll just say one thing about symbols and symbolic dimensions. Symbols have extremely powerful effects on the human consciousness, right? They have a powerful effect. That's why you see them in religious things, all different areas. So the use of symbolism, especially for people that are ignorant of what that symbol means or how what it's doing to them, is a very important part of that. And I think the Grateful Dead is the exemplars of embedding all of this stuff to the point where you really have to dig to find what's in there, trying to understand their lyrics. And figuring out, and their lyrics are written by a hermetic linguist, so extremely complex with multiple meanings, also with a very powerful effect on the subconscious mind of the listener, right? So this goes into, you know, Chomsky and linguistics and this understanding of language, and so it's actually word magic to a certain extent.
Right. Well, you know, I wanted to add to that that, you know, aside from John Perry Barlow, who's a known agent, and some of these other guys, even Jeff Rentz's brother, Rip Rentz, was writing for the Grateful Dead. And apparently Rip and Jeff Rentz's father, Arthur Rentz, was a propagandist and PR manager for Howard Hughes and Hughes Aircraft and Douglas Aircraft.
Wow. I mean, I've always wanted Jeff Rentz's hair, and I just never
yeah,
did.
Well, you know, I mean, it's really cute, the, you know, the I don't know what you call that. It's indescribable.
It's, I think it's the ultimate mullet.
The ultimate, it's worse than a mullet.
It's a meta mullet. It's a para mullet.
It's something to be pondered.
Well, if he's listening, he's going to be mad at me. But no, it's okay. But I'm going to just review a little bit of the stuff we talked about before. And so one of the things that was going on along with all the LSD research was, of course, research into parapsychology, research into synthetic telepathy. And so that was something that was a big part of DARPA was working with that, right? So we have Baccio, who is a whistleblower formerly with DARPA, and he's talking about actually developing the developing of synthetic telepathy, that is beaming thoughts into people's heads, you know, utilizing cell phone towers, etc. And he's actually tried to file lawsuits against it. But that's to a certain extent what the Grateful Dead were working on. And I just lost my sheet here. Just give me a second. Behind the scenes, you know. But so anyways, let's why don't you go ahead and just play that little clip. This was on TV and they're on the Playboy After Dark. And that's the same night that Hugh Hefner gets an astrological reading.
Armed to the teeth with buck knives.
Jerry, the Grateful Dead has been a part of the San Francisco scene for about 4 or 5 years.
Right.
Is the hippie scene changing now? I understand that...
we're all big people now.
Certainly big in terms of publicity, etc., but I understand the Haight-Ashbury scene has changed a good deal.
Well, Haight-Ashbury is just a place, you know, it's just a street, and it's not really the thing... It never was the thing that was going on.
That was just the thing that got the publicity.
Right. That's the thing people could talk about because it's, like, easy to remember.
Well, they held, like, what, about a summer ago, they held a funeral for hippiedom.
Right, and that was like, that was all of us saying, we're not going to tell anybody anymore what we're doing.
Start enjoying it again, huh?
Right.
Well, I noticed that with your own group, you've got kind of a stereo effect going on here with drums.
Yeah.
You have two complete sets of drums and two drummers, obviously for a purpose.
Right. But mutual annihilation.
I see. In other words, the guys kind of compete with one another. And,
well, they more chase each other around. It's kind of, it's like the serpent that eats its own tail, you know, and it goes round and round like that. And if you can stand in between them, they make big figure eights on their sides in your head.
I don't think I'm going to stand between them. I think I'll
take your pick.
Stay back a little ways. But I noticed that the guys are near their instruments here.
Yes.
And the kids have kind of settled down. I wonder if we could get you to do a number for us.
Absolutely not.
Good. Well, hold a second.
Mountains of the Moon. That's the one, the big one up there. Good night.
And then Jerry's there and he's talking about our music's like a snake swallowing its own head in a figure eight going around.
And Ouroboros. These
embedded codes like in that too. And it's like this LSD language or this language that is actually, this is like the hypnotic language. If you look at, is it directly, you know, going off of Ericksonian hypnosis where you have phrases, you make a sentence and you emphasize certain words of those sentence. So like Erickson could talk to somebody and put them into hypnotic trance. They won't even know by emphasizing certain words and modulating the speech and things like that. And this is also used by pickup artists, right? You can use that if you're, you know, if you're trying to, you know, get some venereal diseases or something. So
if you can't get it otherwise, you got to hypnotize.
Exactly.
Oh.
But so let's just shift a little bit, talk about Owsley Stanley. You know, when you start, as you guys have done, you start getting into the whole LSD stuff. There's just so many names, so many interconnections of different people. And I could go in so many different directions, you know, from Rockefellers to Kornmeyer to, you know, whatever. I'll just try to stay just directly here on Owsley. And so Owsley, as we know, is Bear, right? He's the cuddly Grateful Dead little bear. He's so cute.
That's the Jerry Bear that everybody refers to. That comes from Stanley Bear Owsley.
Yeah. Well, it was based off of him. Yeah.
Yeah. Why did they call it the Jerry Bear then?
I don't know. Well, they called him Bear, right? His nickname was, everyone called him Bear.
Right.
And, you know, that's a good, I think the idea for the bear, I think Jerry is maybe a little more cuddly than Owsley. Owsley was a pretty intense guy.
Right.
But so basically Owsley Stanley was from a very prestigious family in Kentucky. His grandfather was a United States Senator, and his father was actually a naval commander, which is not, it's pretty hard to find any information about his father, actually. You know, his father is kind of obscure. His father also was a lawyer for the U.S. government. And so basically,
wait, Hans, are you suggesting that Stanley Bear Owsley has the same governmental intel background is like 90% of these other guys we've already exposed?
Well, you know what? I have to say no, because he didn't get along with his family, and he left home, and so he just wasn't connected with his family at all, just like Jim Morrison. So there's no intelligence connection there.
Oh, because yeah, right. So you're being sarcastic, obviously, for the audience who didn't catch that.
Yeah,
yes, exactly the same background that was first exposed by Dave McGowan, that all of these musicians, et cetera, were the sons and daughters of Intel, and, you know, senators and governors and things like that should probably be included in that.
Yeah, and the thing is that, you know, again, I had to look through a number of obituaries. His father is, it's very hard to find direct, clear information on his father. You know, they just mentioned, you know, the breakdown with his parents and et cetera. He never talked to them again, whatever. But there's very little information on his father, you know, again, except that he was a naval commander and was a government lawyer. So anyone pulls up some more info on that, that'd be great. But Owsley, you know, was a highly precocious, very smart kid. Until he committed himself to St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C. He committed himself.
At age 16, no less.
Yes.
Yeah, because that's what 16-year-olds do. They walk into mental institutions and they turn themselves in without their parents being there, apparently.
And, you know, that's also where they held Ezra Pound, you know, the American poet.
Right.
But St. Elizabeth's Hospital.
That's where Ernest Hemingway had Ezra Pound in locked up. Did I ever show you that that letter that
I did? You did, yeah.
Yeah, that one. I'll show that on screen here too, so people can see what a scoundrel and dirtbag Ernest Hemingway was, in case you didn't already know. He was a double agent. We know he was KGB, but it's clear that he was CIA and U.S. Intel as well.
Yeah, and I would say Hemingway is one of those people, though, that, you know, how many people believed the Bolshevik narrative, right? How many people thought it was a great idea? And, you know, and then, you know, I said I've met literal actual Maoist guerrillas and stuff like that, and they're very articulate. They're very hard to talk to because it's all Marxist doctrine. But they believe that this is going to help the people, and by any means necessary, even if you have to go back to year zero and wipe out culture. And it's the same thing, you know, as the same play of the, you know, that, you know, we're breaking the barriers of our consciousness and smashing all these horrible restrictive boundaries so I can go out and have sex with sheep. Why can't I have sex with dogs? Why can't I, you know,
I'm restricted by these cultural guidelines and boundaries of good behavior. Oh, awful.
Yeah. And unless I have, like, you know, 500,000 sexual partners a year, my life isn't fulfilled. I'm hemmed in, you know, as Kinsey would say. And of course, Kinsey's a whole nother aspect of this. Get, you know, Kinsey is, you know, that's another example, though, of this mind control procedures where, and in fact, even Life magazine really featuring Time magazine, Life magazine, giving these guys the hagiography, right? The biography of saints. Same thing with Mary Pranksters. It's very, very hard to find the dirt on them. And I did read a quote before, but I love this quote from Mountain Girl talking about how they used a type of tape delay that affects with your neural processing, right? So you can't think and you can't talk. And they said, oh, we had this very expensive strobe light system that someone's brother borrowed from the Stanford Research Institute for our acid test. And this is like a $50,000 piece of equipment that's just showing up at the acid test. And that's of course, that's just a coincidence.
You know, I have the recording of Mountain Girl, whom I've met before, her presentation at the MAPS conference. And I need to go back through all of those MAPS presentations, because no doubt there's a ton of good meat in there. And she discusses her, you know, work with the Merry Pranksters and stuff in there. Of course, it's all spin, but no doubt we can go through and pull out some good little nuggets in there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you got Michael Hollingshead, you know, coming out of here, founding the, the Institute for British American Cultural Exchange, which is a nice little, another LSD distribution network. But anyways, not to jump ahead of our story. And Stanley, you know, this countercultural icon, attended the Charlotte Military Academy, which is a very prestigious military academy. And I sent you a document for that, of the list of graduates of that academy. And what's really funny is in the brochure for the military academy, they say sound man for the Grateful Dead and LSD manufacturer and for the military academy, and they promote patriots. But anyways, so, you know, he had a good background, smart guy, besides, you know, putting himself in St. Elizabeth's. And what was going on in St. Elizabeth's? John, I'm just asking you sort of a rhetorical question there.
Oh, well, mind control experiments by the CIA. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, so we have the MK Ultra.
Maybe diddling little kids too, I don't know. Maybe just throw in some extra stuff because there were evil bastards, you know.
Yep, yeah. Well, no, that's taking away your freedom, Jan. You know. There's a Zappa has a song, he's like,
never mind taking away other people's freedom from being diddled by psychopaths.
Yeah. And I'll just add a little aside here, like Frank Zappa has a song, he's like, freedom is where you don't have to do nothing or be nothing. I want to be free. But actually Zappa, you know, refers to his mockery of the hippies in a song, you know, go to San Francisco, I'll go to San Francisco, I'll sleep on Housley's floor, you know, I'll get the crabs, whatever. So little aside there, Zappa. But anyways, Housley, you know, after that, you know, and if you look at the Wikipedia, he suddenly jumps from that to basically manufacturing LSD and becoming the major LSD manufacturer in the world. But we'll just backtrack a bit. And so basically, as he was, his family, again, you know, Kentucky governor, son of a naval commander, he joined the Air Force, where he studied advanced electronics, radar, and also a radio operator. And then he studied at the University of Virginia, and then he worked at JPL, Jack Parsons Laboratory, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where, of course, we have that whole Jack Parsons thing, as, you know, we've talked about, Mr. Jack Parsons, who was blown up and was working with L. Ron Hubbard, you know, trying to create the moon child, the, you know, Antichrist, the holy sacred child, and he was in direct communication with Aleister Crowley, et cetera, Robert Heinlein, all these guys were hanging out there.
I'm sure you saw my expose of JPL and Jack Parsons with Steve Outram, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah. And so just saying that Mr. Owsley was there. So just another, these are all coincidences, and, you know, I don't...
Yes, we don't want to knock the CIA's coincidence theory.
Yeah. And then after that, he enrolled at UC Berkeley, and he decided to go to UC Berkeley because he saw the Bolshoi Ballet and wanted to become a ballet dancer.
Oh, of course. Right. Yeah. After he had all of that training in the military, et cetera, he wanted to dance around in tights.
And he studied Russian. He wanted to join the Bolshoi. He studied Russian and ballet.
Oh, so then he wanted to go to Russia to do the ballet and be a Russian spy, maybe.
I don't know. You know, who knows? But unfortunately, he didn't stay there that long because he started, through the folk scene. I mentioned the Anthology of American Folk Music. Well, the first sort of vector of the spread of hallucinogens was through the sort of tail end of the Beat Generation and the folk scene. And so Owsley was, decided to start designing advanced sound equipment and decided to become a chemist. So this guy is a genius. I mean, he's electronic engineer, radio engineer, professional ballet dancer, Russian speaker, and now he's, decides to become a chemist. But so in terms of Owsley's narrative, I think it's good to maybe go to his own words here. But let me just finish up real quick, just the overview. They started working with Melissa Cargill and a guy named Scully. He started making his laboratory, producing massive...
Tim Scully.
And producing massive doses of LSD. I think he was friends with, of course, Billy Mellon Hitchcock, also Alexander Shulgin, who is a chemist. Alexander Shulgin, chemist at Dow Chemical, who also invented ecstasy.
Who was also working for the DEA and who was also a member of Bohemian Grove.
Yeah, and then he was known as the Pied Piper of LSD. He went around and he would carry a spray bottle and just literally spray people in the mouth with extremely potent liquid LSD. So he dosed hundreds of people against their will. He was known as just walking around spraying people, you know, or dosing people's drinks. So real nice thing to do because LSD is actually bringing about the new age of peace and tranquility, ending war.
What, by giving people bad psychotic trips because they think they're losing it because they don't know they were dosed.
Yeah, and Owsley, you know, this servant of humanity also started making STP, the formula he got from Shulgin. Sorry, say the name again. I pronounced his name.
Alexander Shulgin. Sasha Shulgin.
Shulgin. That's all right. All right. I didn't want to have one of those brain freezes where I keep pronouncing the name incorrectly.
I met Shulgin before, too. You know, in fact, in one of the articles, as I was exposing him, he died.
Yeah. Maybe you killed him, Jan.
No, definitely not.
But pretty much, I mean, there was no one who did more. In fact, you could say he really was. You've got Leary and all these other people. But in terms of distributing millions and millions of tabs of LSD to networks as well, right? So two networks of these bands, well, maybe the Grateful Dead, maybe the Mary Pranks, and you're traveling around distributing it through the country. So did more than any other person to spread LSD throughout the country. And then right before he went to jail, he started making STP, stands for Serenity, Tranquility, and Peace. And he made this, after he got the recipe, he said his goal was to have people enter more quickly into a spiritual state when they take LSD. Now, the only thing about STP is STP, if you take a small overdose, it produces intense psychotic reactions that last over 24 hours. Paranoia, psychosis, you know, fear. It's an extremely powerful drug. And it's supposed to be taken at doses of 1 to 12 milligrams max. And he was making 200 milligram tabs of STP. Now, the thing about STP, unlike LSD, it takes a longer time to take effect, right? So people were taking STP and their trip hadn't started yet. They're like, hey, man, I'm going to take another tab, bro. I want to connect with God. And so STP, you know, you could even see that possibly connected with, a lot of these bad trips that were happening. You got Wavy Gravy spreading bad LSD at Woodstock. Wavy Gravy, another great guy, great counterculture figure. But anyways, and then unfortunately, Owsley, you know, got arrested. So he got busted. You know, he the man came after him finally. They finally got him. They finally stopped the outlaw. And after making millions upon millions of hits of LSD, he spent 2 years in jail. After which he came out and designed the new Grateful Dead psychotronic weaponry sound system. But at that period when he was in jail, who took over the LSD trade? The Brotherhood of Eternal Love.
Who was being run out of Idlewild about 40 minutes from here. And that was tied with, Timothy. Timothy Leary, Michael Hollingshead again, who we haven't mentioned for a second. We have, the whole gang of guys. Ronald Stark Shitsky shows up with the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, etc. So. And it's possible that Terrence McKenna was running into them in Kathmandu when they were doing all of their trade between Kathmandu and the U.S. et cetera, running hashish, et cetera.
Yeah, and, well, I mean, Roland Stark is, you know, counterintelligence, you know,
Ronald Stark.
He was, you know, major counterintelligence connections.
And that's Ronald Stark Shitsky his last name is Shitsky Shitsky.
Oh, that's his real name. So
yeah, Shitsky is his real name.
I would change that name too, man. Maybe that's why he did it. But Stark is one of the most, I mean, this is a guy where there's no question. I mean, he was working to overthrow governments, run government coups. He was also untouchable. He was, you know, arrested in Italy. And then the guy that arrested him got a call saying, you got to let this guy go. And right after that, the arresting officer died immediately afterwards. So he basically just, you know, skated away. But the Brotherhood of Eternal Love is that, you know, of course, that gang with that whole cult. And that's where we see kind of the dark side of the 60s coming in. And that, and Owsley kind of let that little gap where he was in jail. And of course, then came back as this, you know, making these very advanced sound systems.
Really quickly there, Hans, if people want to learn more about the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, etc., they can read a couple of books, Acid by David Black. All of these books, of course, are in my opinion, written by counterintelligence, and I've exposed them in my Spies and Academic Clothing article. But you can still go through and get good tidbits out of this, out of their books. But there's a book called The Brotherhood of Eternal Love by Tendler and May that also goes into all of this. And I've, you know, got this stuff laid out in the brain database, his connections. Unfortunately, David Black's book, Acid, doesn't really lead to any conclusions. It's sort of a limited hangout again, just like most of these books of the, you know, the intel community loves to write their own books to control the dialogue about intelligence activities, about the counterculture. They're the ones who write all these books. Oh, there's just no evidence of the CIA creating the counterculture. And never mind all of these agents right here. They're all wrong and they're all saying it. We just got to ignore them. And never mind these documents, you know. So the whole goal is to control the entire conversation that the public receives about intelligence operations, you know, and especially with the CIA committing, you know, full-on treason and violating its charter since it was conceived. You know, I mean, the whole organization needs to be shut down and disbanded.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's you know, truly the case. And the fact is, yeah, there's a lot of books, and I saw another book recently. I'm not recalling the name, but they talk about how the CIA worked to shut down Abbie Hoffman. The revolutionary was being shut down by the CIA. We went into
That's the whole story of John Lennon, dude. I mean, it's just complete nonsense because they were CIA, they were MI6. Why the hell would the CIA be shutting down their own guys?
Yeah, I mean, Lennon. It's possible Lennon, to a certain extent, was mind controlled. There's a story of when he was at this party in somewhere in Los Angeles, he started smashing all the mirrors and and basically spent a number of years just as a zombie shooting up heroin and watching TV. But, you know, that being said, these, whether they're inadvertent players, whether they're locked into something, they get in too far, you know, but I would say the Grateful Dead, I would certainly classify the Grateful Dead as people that were fully aware of what they're doing and in fact embraced it. Just real quick before I start playing Owsley talking himself, Owsley also, like, they set up, the Merry Pranksters. We'll hear him talk about it, but he first, you know, he had taken psychedelics, but he went to the Merry Pranksters, their acid test, and had a horrible trip. He's, you know, and he'll talk about this in detail, and I found it to be pretty convincing. And he almost died in a car accident, went back to talk to Kesey. Kesey just laughed in his face. And then a couple weeks later, he suddenly decides to start making LSD for him, which is weird. I don't know why.
Contradictions at all, folks.
And then they decided to move their little acid test house to Watts, right near where they had Operation Midnight Climax, and, you know, right next to the CIA safe houses.
Well, and then, you know, they're all on Perry Lane and all of this stuff, too, up in Palo Alto. I mean, it's just all coincidence that they're all right there by SRI and where all of this stuff is going on. I mean, it's just serendipity, Hans.
All of this started in Palo Alto, right? So we think of San Francisco. Right. It actually is Palo Alto, where you was the SRI. But I want to talk a little bit about Owsley's religious beliefs. But first, let me just play some clips of Owsley talking about his meetings with the Pranksters and what he got out of it. So here we are. Clip one.
They did specific things. They did specific things. They made specific sounds. They did specific stuff, loop tape machines together, do delays and get reverberation, which the sound reinforcing itself. And there's a certain persistence, like when you're really high, you move your hand, you get a smear. Well, there's also other kinds of persistence. And they reinforced all these things. How they came upon them, it seemed as though they had rediscovered something from ancient ways, from ancient times. A lot of the music that's used in shamanic rituals does the same thing, which we discovered later. But this was totally came up in isolation. None of these people in the Gizi scene had any roots in the shamanistic rituals at all. That was the other group of people that I'd run into every so often that were more into those things. You know, the Millbrook guys and the rest of those guys, and the, you know, Janiger, all those guys, they were more into that. Whether they actually got into the rituals or not, because I just had some contacts with them, you know, take a few trips with them and that sort of thing, but not, didn't follow that line, didn't go down, never went to an Indian peyote meeting, although I always had the desire to do so, and I never went to a curandero in Mexico with the mushrooms or any of those things. So I've never actually seen it, but from the best that I can figure out, all those rituals contained a lot of the elements which the pranksters discovered or rediscovered or invented or something.
Probably not that much of a surprise, though. I mean, there's... I certainly have the belief that a lot of that stuff is in here.
It must be.
The reason a lot of this stuff is we get that recognition from it is that some of it emanates from our own neurology and DNA.
You read this one, haven't you?
No, I haven't.
You know that book?
It's really interesting.
Intoxication. Ronald Siegel.
Okay, so that's Owsley talking about them. They're conducting rituals, right? They're using shamanic ritual stuff. So, which I think is interesting, again, in that when you look at most of the discourse about the Merry Pranksters, they talk about the Merry Pranksters just as these guys just tripping balls and tweaking some stuff and freaking out. He's talking about them discussed using specific types.
Yeah, and his language is very specific about the specific things that they were doing.
Yeah. Well, let's move on just another...
And why would a bunch of guys that were just druggies hanging out playing music, why would they be interested in all of this specific stuff and everything? Wouldn't it just be letting it loose and going with the flow rather than copying made-up rituals? I mean, you know, they're probably referring to Maria Sabina. He's talking about the curanderos in Mexico, etc. But Maria Sabina came out in 1981 trying to expose Gordon Wasson, saying that they never did any of this stuff before Wasson went down there, and that they never used the mushrooms to find God, that they were strictly used for healing for the sicknesses that the Mazatec suffered from. And, of course, in the English translation of Alvaro Estrada's book, they even let Wasson write the introduction to the book, trying to thwart Maria Sabina's own exposure of him in the same said book.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. Well, I'm just keep going, because Owsley has a lot of great things to say here. So here we go, more about the pranksters.
You recover from all those, I guess, if you're tough, and I guess most of us were. Occasionally some people weren't. It's unfortunate, but because of the way in which it was undertaken in those days, and the fact that we used to take huge amounts of acid. We used to take 250, 300 mics or more. Kesey preferred 400 or more. And Albert Hoffman told me that was a substantial overdose. I says, yes, in retrospect, we realize it was. But
what do you consider an optimum dose?
Oh, I don't know.
So, you want to make any comments on that? But I have some more details. But what I've noticed, both with Kesey and Owsley, I mean, some people couldn't handle it. No, they were people that went a percentage of people went completely psychotic, right? They lost their minds from these acid tests, right? People, they were insane. They were dysfunctional. Their lives were destroyed. And it's like they couldn't handle it. They weren't tough enough. And that's the whole sort of ethos. Again, the peace and love. As I mentioned about, you know, Mr. Ken Kesey, Mr. Happy-Go-Lucky, peace and love. You know, the Hells Angels is raping a woman and they're all taking acid at the acid test and hanging out. Oh, it's her trip, man. It's okay. It's her trip. She's in her movie. So there was a degree of, you know, whatever you want to call it, but this idea of peace and love, you see an absence of compassion. Okay, here we go. This is a little bit interesting. His concept of the mind, thought being electricity, electrical manipulation of the brain. Owsley again.
Behavior of thought and mentation has electronic nature to it. There's a flow of electrons.
Hmm.
And in fact, one of the things, very interesting thing, this is very interesting too, as a little side, about how psychedelics affect you and how you interact with not only consciousness, but we found that some of the psychedelics seem to affect our way, our ability to interact with inanimate equipment.
Really?
Specifically, when someone at a show or when in a room where someone was playing music was to take some DMT, which is a rather powerful psychedelic, the music would immediately become louder and more strident and
No, the other people would notice that.
Absolutely, everybody. Everybody. It just does it does a thing. And it has a certain tonality to it, a certain quality to it, which is very distinctive. So we decided that none of us could, we generally could all do it, right? And we thought, oh, well, that's just one of those things. But then I got on that, back to that thing that I'd learned from Melissa, is that don't assume that this is an illusion caused by the substance. Mm-hmm. Believe it's real. So I said, hey, I believe this is real. Well, one thing we noticed was that the tubes would get red hot and burn out half the time, and it would tear the voice coils out of the speakers.
Okay. So there he's, he goes a little bit more into this, but the fact he is, you know, fully aware of the electrical nature of the brain, right? So he's also talking about, this connects with research, you know, into, again, what do you call it, telekinesis, et cetera. But at the same time, he is referring to the fact that thought is electrical and the electrical nature of the music. And Filesh says the same thing about this music being electrical. It's electricity. It affects the brain because of its, you know, the use of electricity, et cetera. I don't know if you want to say anything on that. It may not be interesting, but his big part of Owsley's philosophy was that when you trip, the trip is real. You accept it as reality. Your LSD experience, your hallucinations are
right.
Real.
Yeah, you don't. Yeah, and that's their thing is they want people, which was part of the whole remarketing that I exposed in my article in Theugen's What's in a Name, was that they wanted people to think that the drug experience was actually reality and not a psychotic break, and that reality itself was psychosis.
Exactly. Okay, let me just play on that line. This is another, he goes into more detail about trips being real.
You see, it was very funny because the lady that I was with in those days was quite direct. Now, her name was Melissa.
And quite direct?
Was, Melissa very direct about everything, right? Uh-huh. So whenever we would get high, this is long before I met the dead, right? But whenever we get high and things would start getting really weird, she would insist on dealing with them as though they were real, not a hallucination, not something that the drug was doing, but this is reality, and forced me to deal with it. So I never got into that space that a lot of people get into, where they say, oh, it's the drug that's doing this. This is a hallucination. This is a non-real effect, which is being produced by a chemical, which is in my brain. I had to deal with it as though this was the absolute concrete everyday reality. Now, deal with it, right? And that was interesting because that's different. It's different that way. See, mm-hmm. you do a whole different. You have a whole different set, right? It's like the difference between sitting in a driving a car in a video game or getting in a car, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she wouldn't let me drive the video game car.
She made you deal with it.
Deal with it on the street now. And so when I got to this point in the acid test, when I saw sound coming out of the speakers, I was totally programmed to accept whatever I saw as being real, more real perhaps than my everyday life, which I had come to believe was restricted consciousness, where I actually saw less or felt less and perceived less. Mm-hmm. And so the telepathy and the almost telekinetic kind of things that go on that you experience when you're on acid, I accept it as real, that they're actually there. And that there are probably people, I thought, that can do this. So the idea of Uri Geller bending the spoon or doing things like that, that never amazed me. That just seemed like, oh, he's figured out how to do it without having to have an amplifier in his system. Mm-hmm. He's got it straight. People who are telekinetic, people who read minds, people who have precognitive
pause
visions.
It for a second.
Oh, well, they've just learned how to do it.
Uri Geller was both Mossad and CIA, ironically. And he's even come out admitting it himself that he was Mossad and CIA. But he worked under Dr. Andrea Puhrich, who was running the 9 out of the Esalen Institute, doing all of this dark occult stuff. And you know, so what we hear is him using these other agents as his reasoning for what he's discussing, and then also pretending that he was programmed to believe that these experiences were real, while he's the one manufacturing the acid, selling it. He's using doublespeak in this talk here to implant, to seed the idea into people that what they are experiencing isn't just the chemistry, that it is real. And then he goes on further to claim that, you know, you're hypersensitive, you're seeing more, you're absorbing more in this drug state than you normally do. Now, I used to be one of those people who believe that. I've done LSD way too many times. I would say more than I care to admit to. I've probably done it close to 300 times, I would guess. Lots of wasted nights and days and everything else that you never get back. But I've seen the things that he's talking about, and then using the trivium method, you can see how the intelligence community has manipulated this and marketed it to get people to believe that it's not a schizophrenogen or psychotomimetic, that this psychotic break is actually a religious experience. So it's all marketing. All they did was remarket the psychotic break as spiritual, and then tell people you need to go in and try it again. And, well, you know, if you can't handle it, well, go back in and do it again, you know?
Yeah. And also, he makes some allusions. Again, they were also conducting all these extensive experiments, again, on telekinesis, on electrical nature of thought, on sound manipulation of thought and electricity. Let me just finish this little quote, because
sure.
it gets way deeper in this, Jan. Just hang on, because Owsley, he, this is a good interview. So a little more here.
I'm doing it for now.
Having faith, and you read all throughout the Hindu stuff. You read about the fakirs who are capable of doing things, translating stuff, levitating their bodies, and manifesting things in the physical world and stuff like that. And people think, well, it's sleight of hand or it's hokum. I don't think it is. I think it is that through their meditative states, they've managed to kick whatever storehouse of whatever it is in your brain that the acid kicks. Only they wanted to do it without acid, which is probably better, but sometimes it takes a lifetime, and not all of them make it.
Very important point. A couple points there. Okay. Number one, and this is exactly what Huxley says, and he repeats this several times, that Huxley said, and Huxley initially was into things like yoga and meditation. Now, you know, there are stories of people developing types of psychic abilities through rigorous discipline, advancing, you know, the mind. He's saying you can do that your whole life. You may never get an experience. LSD is giving you that. LSD is giving you psychic powers. LSD can make you levitate. And whatever you see on your trip is more real than your day-to-day concrete reality. And that's the thing that Huxley said. And that's what I find to be really sort of disgusting in that way, is that from people that actually want to develop their consciousness, which requires discipline and practice, they're being told that they're getting it from the LSD, that LSD is actually doing the same thing. That, you know, if you, you know, when you're an athlete in peak condition or whatever, you know, extremely advanced intelligence, LSD is doing the same thing to your brain. But this idea that the psychotic trip is real, that the psychotic break is more real and it's freeing you from the restrictions, is an extremely dangerous idea. If you believe that idea, you'll just keep taking more. You absolutely lose touch with reality completely. But the other thing about Owsley is that I want to stress that he's not really spiritual. He's very much on the scientific, technical aspect. He even mentioned, I didn't go to peyote ceremonies. I didn't go to any of these traditional things. I wasn't interested. And we'll see what his actual beliefs are. But he's very much into this technological, technotronic alchemy, I would describe as. So now I'm going to play a quote. This is Owsley meeting the dead. Then there's some pretty interesting stuff here, though. So here we go.
Out of maybe 10,000 people who follow the yogic practices, maybe three or four get to the state of becoming that kind of a high master.
I would imagine.
I found it very interesting.
And interesting enough so that I went down several more times. And one of the times when I was, and I had heard about this band, which was the first time I went down there, they were calling the Warlocks. And I didn't pay that much attention to it, except they were obviously all excited about it. And the next time
maybe
I went,
the Pranksters, you mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Next time I went down, someone came in and said they just picked the name Grateful Dead. I think it was Mountain Girl.
Uh-huh.
Came in and said that. Said, oh, they've got a new name. They've named themselves. They couldn't be the Warlocks because some band in Florida had that name. Which band? I never heard of.
No,
after
Lynch,
that, I don't know whether they really existed or not. But that
Lynch
was
told me the same thing. He said he was looking through records in a store and saw something by the Warlocks. And he said, and he went back and said, hey, you guys, we can't be the Warlocks. But he said he never found that record again. And then I found out that Lou Reed was in a band called the Warlocks before he was in the Velvet Underground.
Oh, yeah.
So it's possible that was the Warlocks, or could be there was, you know,
the story I heard was a band that was in Florida or something.
Well, okay.
That was anyway.
So they changed their name to Grateful Dead.
And I didn't actually see them play until I went to the Mirror Beach acid test, and that's when I saw them play. Whether or not I ran into Garcia or someone else at Kesey's during those visits, I don't really recall. The only person other than Mountain Girl and George Walker.
Okay. So that's just... Yeah, just basically, you know, he's meeting the dead. But the name, you have the Grateful Dead again. That ties into of course, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And I think, was it in Michael Hollingshead ordered like thousands of copies of that book to distribute? And Ella,
right, in England on Leary's marching orders, which I cover in the article in Thugen's What's in a Name. And, yeah, you know, Leary gave Michael Hollingshead marching orders to go back to England, because here's the real kicker that exposes this whole thing that you're talking about, is nobody in England was getting the spiritual message of LSD. It was just considered a rebellious drug. And Hollingshead goes over there to sell this spiritual message. And Michael Hollings said, this is from his book, he says, from what I had heard in letters and conversations, the psychedelic movement in England was small and badly formed. It appeared that those who took LSD did so as a consciously defiant authoritarian gesture. The spiritual content of the psychedelic experience was being overlooked. So this is exactly what they're talking about. And we hear Owsley discussing this, and then, you know, Leary and they're all out of the Harvard Social Relations Department. Leary sends Hollingshead over to England with a bunch of copies of Leary's book with Ralph Metzner to sell this. So and Dick Alpert or Ram Dass. But here's from Leary and Metzner and Alpert's book. Of course, the drug dose does not produce the transcendent experience. It merely acts as a chemical key. It opens the mind, frees the nervous system of its ordinary patterns and structures. The nature of the experience depends almost entirely on set and setting. Set denotes the preparation of the individual, including his personality structures and his mood at the time. Setting is physical, the weather, the room's atmosphere, social, feelings of persons present toward one another, the cultural prevailing views as to what is real. Prevailing views as to what is real. So they're trying to insinuate that, you know, it's everything is primacy of consciousness. We live in a Kantian delusion. It's Roger Rabbit land, essentially. And we shouldn't believe that anything is real. We shouldn't have common sense. We need to believe in nonsense, what cannot be sensed, right? And so he goes on, it is for this reason that manuals or guidebooks are necessary, or they go on. Their purpose is to enable a person to understand the new realities. Okay, so now they're saying things that aren't real, that are drug-induced, are realities. It's like Like my show with Professor J. Courtney Fikes, we talk about Carlos Castaneda and his book, This Separate Reality, right? They manufacture this drug-induced hallucination, and then they call it reality. And boy, now you need to get into that other reality. See? And so, let's see, the purpose is to enable a person to understand the new realities of expanded consciousness. Never mind, you're high, you're delusional, it's a psychotic break. It's being remarketed as expanded consciousness. It's all doublespeak. It's all spin. To serve as roadmaps for the new interior territories which modern science has made accessible.
Ah, and I'll just throw this in here, which is fascinating, in that this idea of the nervous system, resetting the nervous system. What Kesey wanted to do, his goal was, there's like this, whatever, 30 millisecond gap or something, or whatever it is, between your when something actually happens and when your brain registers it. He was trying to shatter that gap. He was trying to go to immediate experience. But what they did at the acid test, they had these deliberately asynchronized lights, distorted music, strange echoes, completely destabilizing the nervous system. Right, so in the mind, so they're trying to absolutely destabilize perception, like these delays I mentioned. That there's when you use those, they're used as weapons. They're used as sonic weapons. If you have someone gets a certain echo on their voice, they literally aren't able to think anymore. And that's exactly what they talk about, that that when these delays are on, when you try to talk, it shuts your mental processing down because of that. And so Kesey was. He said that was his goal, to free the mind, to break free. Let's just keep going here.
Yeah, you know, and who is he? You know, you're breaking free, okay, but yeah, you're being put under hypnosis and social control by the CIA and a bunch of psychopaths. So how is that free exactly? But yeah,
but it's depatterning. You're talking, I think Owsley may have even said depatterning, or, you know, depatterning. You're depatterning your mind and your nervous system and your body to go into this psychedelic reality that you're being indoctrinated to believe is real. And this is science, right? But let me just keep going here. This, from Owsley.
Freaky that that I thought they were messing with something that was probably very dangerous, is what I thought. This is not so good.
Oh, wait, not so good? They were going to be bigger than the Beatles. This is not so good.
That was them. That was my. That was me standing in the room listening to them play their set.
Uh-huh.
I thought that, right? And then, but then then I went into, I went on a cosmic trip into other chambers of the universe and for the rest of that night. And then, the next day or a few days later, I talked to Kesey. I says, "Hey, you know, you're messing with stuff from ancient stuff, right? This is, and without any maps, where this maybe not, maybe you need to be careful about this." It was kind of scary. And he kind of laughed at me. Well, it's sort of like the guy that that gets on a roller coaster for the first time. Supposing some guy was a Yanomami Indian or something. Right, and he comes out of the forest, and the first thing he does, somebody puts him on a roller coaster. Right, he's never even seen civilization, somebody puts him on a roller coaster.
Right. He's going to go back and say, "Boy, civilization."
No, no. What it is that you'll get off that thing and say, "That's very dangerous. That's scary." Right.
Oh, I see.
And yet other people go around and around again and again and again.
Wait, you had taken acid a lot.
Oh, I think
it wasn't the acid that was the scary part. It was the Grateful Dead.
No, it wasn't the Grateful Dead.
The linkage was the scary part.
Yeah, the prankster thing. The prankster thing, right.
Which
the Grateful Dead were part of. I mean, Grateful Dead were pranksters.
Right.
They were musicians. They were also pranksters. It was like, the next time I saw them was at the Fillmore acid test, and I met Phil, and I walked over to him.
So.
He just shows up at all of the acid tests, right? But sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, well, this is interesting, and I have more. He talks about this more, but he talks about the Grateful Dead actually doing occult type of rituals, right? And this is, and he talks about this as, you know, being, again, as being extremely dangerous, and then he's being afraid. In fact, he ran away from it. But then he ends up going back and manufacturing LSD for them. So that it's kind of odd. But then, but he does say that this music was dangerous. What they were doing was dangerous. And then he throws on that little, you're not man enough if you can't handle it. But I mean,
all right, you know what? Let's think for a moment about his whole stint at St. Elizabeth's Hospital. And he's there for probably psychotic breaks or whatever, at least is the official story. And then he's selling or marketing psychotic breaks as this spiritual thing. Now, why would Owsley be doing that? And then why would he be afraid of it? That's because he knows. And then, you know, he's like, well, you know, I'm just going to manufacture the LSD and help him out. And I'm going to show up at all of these acid tests for the Merry Pranksters. You know, and, you know, and clearly, if the, you know, the Grateful, I mean, not that the Grateful Dead haven't already outed themselves with all of their admissions. You know, the only person we pretty much don't have a recording or an article saying, admitting that he was CIA is Jerry, but that doesn't, you know, that's not to deny that he was an integral part of this whole CIA operation. I absolutely think that Jerry was, and in fact, he was extremely well-read and read up on all of the latest scientific articles and all of this stuff. I mean, he was no idiot. He was no just bumbling, you know, lead singer guitarist. He was, you know, up on all the latest mind control research, like Aldous Huxley would have been.
And as is Owsley as well.
And as is Owsley.
Yeah. Let me just, now, I want to, play a quote, that, but I want to stress again, this idea of opening up energies for these other forces. Now, okay. This is something that you go back into the earlier literature of a lot of these secret societies. One of the major goals was to, quote unquote, open up the astral channel, the crown chakra, so you could receive messages from the master, right? This was used as group mind control.
Never mind who the master is, but...
Exactly. And this is exactly what he is talking about, opening up. And now let's see what he's actually interested in. So now he directly says what kind of visions that he achieved on LSD. Here we go.
So we have the three major... religions that are connected with the materialistic culture in the Western world, and science, which was the remaining investigative urge remaining from alchemy, which was a philosophy about the world, the life, universe, God, what it is, because of the belief that the practitioners of alchemy had that they could understand the universe by manipulating the physical things, which then became chemistry and physics and so forth, that by understanding the rules by which the universe was put together, they could extrapolate these rules into the unseen universe and into other things, because alchemy teaches that as above, so below. If you understand something that works on one level, you can understand it on another. And a common example of this is the similarity, the structure of the solar system and the structure of an atom, which
That's
can
right.
be represented or thought about in a similar fashion.
We've seen her coming back to that now as this chaos theory emerges and fractals and stuff as a way of explaining.
Well, I always thought of it like alchemy itself was like a seed, because it embodied very basic concepts, usually described as the seven principles. And that from that seed, when it was planted, grew basically two trees, or two plants. One plant we call chemistry, the other plant we call physics. There was also biology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all the different disciplines, but two basic disciplines, which are physics and chemistry, which are two distinct ways of looking at the physical interactions of objects in the universe. One, the mechanical interactions, when the chemical interactions, the reactive interactions. But as these sciences developed, and as they began to dig deeper and deeper and deeper into the structure of matter, all of a sudden it wasn't solid anymore. It became vibrational, became energetic, became fields. And things like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which says you can't describe everything about something appear, and all kinds of different things all start it starts to get very strange and turns back into just vibration. You deal with it as vibration. So you might say that the plants grew up and they flowered, the flowering being modern technology, and then they set seed, and the seed is out. You can flip back again. Right. Same thing. That's just the way. That's the way I look at it.
Okay. So he is deeply into alchemy, deeply. And in fact, I wanted to read some quotations from his the Kabbalon, which is the book that he follows. But in this they talk about the principle of vibration, the use of vibration, the use of music and rhythm, and how to basically to destroy an undesirable rate of mental vibration, put into operation the principle of polarity, and concentrate upon its opposite pole to that which you desire to suppress. Kill out the undesirable by changing its polarity. So he talks about using these attributes, like in society, left, right, you know, like we have the left, right dichotomy. We have the whole gender, transgender thing. By using these and using it as a sort of a way to eliminate or destroy or transmutate. And so even he's saying that alchemy is the seed of all this technology. We're going back to alchemy through LSD, through electricity, through technology. And so, you know, but again, in his religious book that he follows, the Kabbalon, principle of vibration, again, principle of polarity, principle of rhythm, and all of these are used for using the will. So this is Crowleyan type of stuff, the use of the will to control matter, to control the mind, to transmutate and transform the others. And so by becoming the master, he pauses, neutralizes the rhythmic swing. Okay, so basically it's using, raising themselves up to a point of almost a godlike nature through their development. And you have, he's not anti-science, right? He's saying that science, we're going back to this occult type of consciousness stuff. I'm going to throw something in there.
I don't have anything to add to that.
Okay. Another quote here.
Let him hear me.
That scared me.
How so?
Oh, it just seemed frightening. They seem to have, all of that seemed to have a connection to a very scary, possibly dangerous aspect of reality to me.
Somebody told me that you pushed a chair around that building.
Yeah, I was pushing a chair.
Made a lot of noise.
Made some noise. Everything was making noise. It was a very noisy place. Well, it seemed like it, yeah.
Tell me more. I'd like to hear your side of that story.
I don't know. I remember pushing the chair around, and I remember all kinds of different things. I remember all kinds of noises and sounds and things. The pranksters would make these noises, and the noises would seem to get inside your nervous system, and as if there was some type of a plug or something in your head, it would get in there and scrape away some kind of a cap. That would make the connection available to be plugged into something.
Uh-huh.
A psychic cable.
For the insulation?
Yeah, you might say. Right.
Alligator clips.
Like a hymen, perhaps. Mental hymen. And then the connection would be made, and all the people would be linked up and start sharing thoughts and images and ideas. And it was like not just thoughts, but little thoughts and concepts, but you saw like a patchwork of images, and you felt a patchwork of body sensations and everything else. It was very definitely a gestalt, multiple mind kind of phenomenon.
Polymorphous synesthesia.
Could be. Yeah, that might be a good term. That would certainly describe it.
Do you think, well, obviously other people felt this too.
But that was the first time anything like that had actually happened to me. It was very weird, scary.
Was that what those guys were working on, do you think? I mean, had that, do you think
nobody would talk about it?
They just did it.
did it. Uh-huh. You didn't talk about it. You just did it. Whatever you had done, whatever was going on in that scene for what, a year or two before I ran into it, they'd slowly but surely built this up. And whether it was instinctive or what, it may be very well be instinctive. Maybe that the psychedelics, all of the psychedelic plants, seem to have a very ancient and direct relationship with man. Uh-huh. As I was attempting to get into that, the cannabis plant seems to specifically.
Okay, so that's pretty interesting admissions in that. I think scraping away inside the brain, creating this group. Collective mind and uses the image
a hive mind, group think, etc.
With an electrical cable connecting everybody, an electrical cable implanted in your head once the cap is scraped off. But he talks about affecting the nervous system. He talks about, so he kind of lets a few things slip, and then at the end, do they know what they're doing? They just did it. I don't know, man. But so what you see here is if we look at the breakdown of the society on the model of the psychic destabilization of society, the society of one is this sort of shared group mind, hive mind that no longer has any connection to any empirical physical reality whatsoever.
Sure. It's the ultimate form of cultural Marxism.
As well as the form of absolutely human consciousness, right?
Right, yeah. They're totally subverting consciousness and awareness itself for the ultimate slave, while they are telling the slave that because they're high on drugs and dancing to music that they're free.
Yeah. Okay, leave that there. But just stating, Owsley, he doesn't come across as a burnout, does he?
No, he sounds like he's pretty aware. Not that he even spent a lot of time in a psychiatric ward at St. Elizabeth's.
Yeah. Okay, I'll just a few more here. So this is where he's talking about using electricity to manipulate DNA, the changing of DNA through sound weapons.
Associated with DNA, yeah, which is millions of atoms. Sometimes, an enormous number of atoms, all of which arranged in a very precise way would order the motion of electrons in a very, very precise and specific and special way.
Which would have frequency and resonances and stuff that we...
I don't know, because, I'm not a scientist.
No, but if you take it as above, so below, then we can assume that there would be ripples and harmonics of that all the way up into perceivable realms, right?
Probably, yeah. Some kinds of telepathy.
Okay, I found the other one. But he just talks about using sound as possibly manipulating DNA. One thing he does, though, he tends to backtrack on certain things. For example, when he talks about detailed discussion of the electronics, he says, well, I don't really know much about electronics. You're an Air Force electronics technician, right? So he says, oh, the other guy did it all. I'm just a hack. I know how to plug some wires in, But so...
And never mind that he's the one who created the wall of sound, right?
Yeah. So we have this idea of as above, so below. But the other aspect of that is if you go into these, these groups, which you've talked about many times, the Sabbateans or whatever, and other people like that, by doing evil, by removing all sanity, orgiastic, everything goes, mass violence, mayhem. By doing that, you actually, this darkness will invert it and bring this light or something like that. So this as above, so below is this, you have that's...
Well, they're trying to quicken the return of the Messiah or whatever, essentially. By doing evil, the Messiah will come faster.
Yeah, but in this case, it's that you're basically... removing the boundaries of consciousness and removing any possibility of connecting with the normal world, and you have to be part of this group hive mind where, again, right, the cap is scraped off inside your brain and a wire is plugged in. That sounds real back.
Well, that's all the transhumanist stuff, and that's exactly what they're trying to do with the computers and technology and this whole Omega Point theory and... What's the thing that they're trying to bring in? I'm just looking for the word for it, but they've got this whole thing that they want in 2045 or a 2045 Avatar project, right?
Yeah.
And so that's when they want everybody cabled and in the hive mind. That's the CIA and intelligence community's goal. All of this transhumanist promotion, et cetera, that's what they are attempting to accomplish.
Yeah. All right, I'll just play another little, just keep going through here.
That's more cyclical than linear, and we like that.
Yeah, well, it's just, yeah, well, everything is cyclical. Hey, we go back to alchemy.
There we go. Right? Good, I like that.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. The whole concept of the universe as a conscious entity, which is dreaming it all up, makes it easy to understand such things as telepathy. And why astrology? Well, astrology is a description of how the cyclical things that you can see in the recurring angles and relationships of the planets can be used to connect or to relate to the nature of events on the Earth. And after hundreds of thousands of years of watching it, people evolved. It's, oh yeah, well, when this happens, well, things are going to, are likely to do this. And over a long period of time, a lot of observation.
Okay, I will play the whole thing. But basically there he's talking about a return to magic and alchemy from science, returning to magic and alchemy as the basis.
And of course, a scientist who's doing all of this stuff, talking about the return of alchemy and magic for everybody else, of course, not for them who are the social manipulators.
Yeah. And it's very interesting. I have a longer excerpt that I won't play, but he says that when you take LSD, you go in and you see that everything, all the Masonic stuff is real. All the Rosicrucian stuff is real. All the magic they talked about in magical text is real. And then, you know, of course, they talk about, then he starts going into ancient Greece and these rituals and stuff like that. But he doesn't say that you go and you take LSD and you see a beautiful experience of nature. You experience Masonic, Rosicrucian, and magical. That is like, you know, black magic. That's what you see, and that's right. The energies you attain. So what we have here is someone who is a promoter of the view of this transhuman idea of, okay, this whole idea of telekinesis and all this stuff and group perception, but do you want to be so you don't, your own mind is completely connected with everyone else's mind and all these thoughts are being beamed in. There's no more, you know, it's an erosion of individuality through technology and LSD as being for the product of science that leads back to the quote unquote ancient wisdom, right? And then, as he's saying, we're now going back, we're cycling back to alchemy and magic as our means of working. But again, alchemy is very much associated with this, you know, whatever you want to call it, agenda, but this idea of, you know, removing any, just debasing of humanity. It's a debasing, collective debasement of humanity so those others can rise to the top, right? You're taking
absolutely.
You're melting down the lead of all the Grateful Dead fans as their brains are being fused into this hive mind, right? And they're ascending with their other masters, so to speak, to this thing. So I just want to say that, see, he obviously, he's into transhumanism, right? And when we have to do another one because I don't have the stuff about the virtual reality, but they see virtual reality and transhumanism as an extension of LSD, as an extension of this. In fact, they're very positive about it. And so they're completely linked with this thread, this narrative and this, agenda.
See, you know, and regarding this whole evolutionary plan, what I said in part two of the series exposing all of this, this is part two, is how Darwin Huxley, which is referring to Thomas Henry Huxley, how Darwin Huxley and the Esalen Institute launched the 2012 and psychedelic revolutions and began one of the largest mind control operations in history. Now, in this article, I say, via the Esalen Institute, this multi-generational plan to evolutionize, their idea of evolution was just for them and the elite, not the rest of society, whom they plan to dumb down and exterminate via their ideas laid forth in their many published books and programs on eugenics and humanism. So this is exactly what we're talking about. They're not planning on evolving anybody, folks. They're planning on enslaving you, having wires plugged into your head, or maybe it'll be Wi-Fi. But, you know, this is the plan. They're not trying to evolve you. The elites, the psychopaths, are incapable of evolving themselves, and the only way they can do it is to push you down.
No, exactly. And let me just play Jerry talking about transhumanism. So this is Mr. Jerry Garcia, and he's basically, oh, here we go. Let's listen to it.
Wandering around, hunting and gathering.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, at the same time, they started painting in caves.
Right.
Started multiplying. So
right.
What this paleontologist that I quoted has the theory that the first art in caves were really psychedelic experiences.
Yeah.
And the reason that they were is so that, because the tribal encyclopedia, the amount of information that people needed to know in order to move to a new way of life,
right,
suddenly increased.
That's right. Yeah, that's
so
a
how
good,
you
that's a good
print?
Notion. Yeah, the point is there's more information now than you can pass along comfortably in an oral tradition,
right.
Say, a strictly speaking culture.
Well,
that's
nobody,
a problem.
Nobody's delineated. Nobody's concentrated.
Right.
There's a lot of extraneous stuff, like, for instance, the satellites that measure the atmosphere.
Yeah.
There's billions and billions and billions of bytes of data. Only maybe 2% of which are actually useful. They don't know what the rest are for. They don't know what good they
that's
are.
That's right.
But
people want to fly through that.
Fill up tanks and things.
Yeah.
And anyway, who knows for sure how complex or how uncomplex the ancient people's lives were. They may have been in many ways as absolutely full and complicated as anything.
I don't think there's any reason to assume they weren't. I mean, if you look at some of these cultures now, and there's still a few of them.
No, that's true. See, but that's what I mean about the singularity.
Yeah.
That the entire human race faced a singularity when one small group.
They were promoting the singularity way back then. This was before Art Bell and Ray Kurzweil were on it.
Exactly, and they're talking about the. This is all. This is Garcia and Owsley's also there. They're talking about the singularity. And then let me just look at virtual. Now they're comparing virtual reality. So they're talking, okay, virtual reality as psychedelics, right? So the similarity between the virtual reality experience and psychedelics. Here we go.
On there, there's you get some kind. You get you're starting to bump into chaos now as the lines between hearing and touch are blurred. You know, now you're starting to get into this kind of chaos. So there, I remember. In some kind of part of that automatic writing kind of psychic literature stuff about Lemuria and ancient Egypt that you bump into occasionally, there was something in there about the fall of the early magically oriented societies pre Atlantean. Was that they something about that they had control over form, and that there was just too great a variety of forms that, you know, people were becoming anything they wanted to, any animal, anything like that, and that part of the process of part of the reaction to it was the desire to restrict the forms to the forms that we are familiar with now. This stuff is all stuff that bubbles out of the subconscious of people. I don't know where it comes from. I don't know. It doesn't have any relation to real history.
He's talking about lycanthropy, etc.
You know, there's a metaphor in there somewhere about that thing of losing some sense of what the bounds of reality are. You know, what your experience is. And I think it's the basic threat of drugs, psychedelics specifically, is somewhere tied into that. And that this virtual reality stuff is the technological equivalent, really, of psychedelics. And I can see that I think that part of it is going to be the thing of being able to make this look like something else, you know, just to avoid that kind of interference. Did you read Barlow's thing about he's just been handing it out? Do you know John?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a side effect.
Yeah. you read his thing about these people who are getting busted, the hackers that are getting busted for.
Yeah,
and of course, John Perry Barlow is one of the agents that we've exposed.
Oh, that's right. Oh, you know all about it. Well, that's that's not even. I mean, here we're not even talking about what the experiences, how the experiences, how it's affecting consciousness, but just the idea that you can move around freely. It seems to be scaring the shit out of something. You know what I mean? Some authoritarian, shadowy, deal is out there.
Some dark shadowy thing out there that wants to control you that we work with.
The whole argument they're making is that we have to keep this virtual reality. Stuff. We'll do this again. We'll go into more details, but basically, you have this promotion of the idea, the singularity. Of Jerry talks about people being able to have cyber sex, where you wear a rubber suit and you're connected with someone, 1,000 miles away, and you're having sex. And he said, "Well, that's a great idea." And basically, what we have to do is keep the man. Don't let the man find out about how good virtual reality is, because they'll make it illegal, just like LSD. They'll stop us. They'll stop us from evolving as human beings.
This is reverse psychology to make people want to run into virtual reality and get these rubber suits, and then they're having virtual sex and not creating real families and real social structures so that they can be controlled. And then they get older and they are left by themselves in a socialist system to support them because they've not created any family or anything to support themselves.
Yeah, and he goes on to say that everyone eventually will just be in their own reality bubble. We'll no longer have any language. People will just be in their own world, and they can share these weird virtual realities and all this stuff. And so this is the goal. This is what they're promoting. This is not an interview for the dead fans. This is more with people in the know. Because a lot of times you see Jerry talk, he's more of the affable, happy hippie. But you can, these guys are very versed in all the technology, and they are
somebody who's just a hapless lead singer for a druggy band shouldn't be so versed in all of the technology and the language and everything that's been going on that we've been exposing for the last several years.
Yeah, and just as a final note, they also reference quite a bit Joseph Campbell and creating new rituals. And what the dead is doing is creating a new ritual structure for a new transformed humanity that has broken away from the boundaries of consciousness and the boundaries of family and the boundaries of, the physical world, because we now we've taken LSD, we've transcended that. So literally that the end game is this, and they talk about being there to help dissolve the families. And dissolve these structures to the ultimate goal is this world. He said, "There's no, we don't need language anymore. We don't need anything. It's just, you just make up your own trip. And then every once a month, you'll get a signal through the plug in your head that will align you with the group consensus signal. So you don't get too far off in your own world." He literally says that as the goal and the next step in evolution. So,
yes, that's really evolution in a twisted, psychopathic intelligence community sense.
Yeah. Well, Jan, I think we need to have to wrap it up here at this point. But
all right.
Continue on. I have lots and lots more of these little nuggets.
So what you're saying is there will be a part three then to this series. It won't be a two-parter.
It looks like that's happened. Sorry.
All right, Hans. Well, I will work on getting this out and part one as quickly as possible. And it's been good having you back on, and we'll see you again soon.
Thanks, John. Take care.
All right. Take care.